Ekhatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. So today we're tackling something pretty fundamental, a question maybe we don't ask often enough. Where does thinking actually happen?
Yeah, it sounds simple, right? The default answer for, well, centuries really, has been in the brain, you know, inside your head.
Locked away in the skull, doing its mysterious thing. But what if that picture, that whole model, is just wrong, or at least incomplete?
That's exactly what we're exploring today. That internalist view, thinking as this private, brain-bound process, it's deeply ingrained. But the work we're diving into, thinking by Sean Gallagher and Zachariah Dorman, it argues for something pretty radical.
A total shift, basically.
A major shift. They're saying we need to move thinking out of just the skull. It involves the whole body, the environment around us, even the tools we pick up and use.
Which brings us to this idea of the 4E model, right?
Yeah.
The idea that our intelligence, our cognition is embodied, embedded, enacted, and extended.
Precisely. And look, this isn't just some, you know, abstract philosophical word game. It has huge real-world implications.
How so?
Well, if we accept this broader view thinking as this whole-body, world-involved activity, it changes everything. How we think about education, workplace design, mental health. Even artificial intelligence.
Right. Understanding what human intelligence actually is seems pretty crucial if we're trying to build artificial versions or just understand ourselves better.
Absolutely. It offers a, maybe a more realistic, more humane picture of who we are as thinkers. And that really matters right now.
So who are the guides on this journey? Gallagher and Dorman. Tell us about them.
Okay, so Sean Gallagher, he's a major figure, a world-renowned philosopher, really one of the key architects of what's called embodied cognition.
And what makes his perspective stand out?
Well, he does this amazing thing where he connects deep philosophical traditions, you know, thinkers who always insisted the body was central to experience, like Merleau-Ponty. He connects that with cutting-edge cognitive neuroscience.
So it's not just theory. He's grounding it in the science of the brain and body.
Exactly. He's not just commenting on this stuff. He helped build the whole field. And his collaborator, Zachariah Dorman, he really helps bridge that gap even further, bringing in findings from cognitive science, especially developmental studies.
Like how kids learn.
Yeah, how kids learn, how we solve problems as adults. It shows how this 4E model isn't just abstract. It plays out in real life from childhood onwards.
Okay, so we've got this powerful combination, deep philosophical roots, meeting hard scientific evidence. They're really pushing back against that old idea, the brain in a box.
They really are. They're passionate about it. They want us to ditch that image of Rodin's thinker. You know, the solitary guy, all hunched over, purely internal struggle. They're saying, no, thinking is out there, in the world, in action.
Which leads us right into the book's main argument. It's a direct hit on centuries of thought, isn't it? That thinking isn't just some hidden internal process.
Correct. They go right after what philosophers call Cartesian dualism. That's the old, stubborn idea, thanks largely to Descartes, that the mind is totally separate from the physical body. A ghost in the machine sort of thing.
And the authors say that's the root of the misunderstanding.
Yeah, they argue it's led us down the wrong path. They spend a good chunk of the book carefully taking apart that mind-body split.
And they also tackle that classic brain in a vat thought experiment, right?
Yeah.
The sci-fi idea that a lone brain hooked up to a computer can still think like a person.
They do. And their take is basically, that's not a deep mystery about consciousness. It's just the absurd conclusion you reach if you take the old brain-only view too seriously.
So a brain alone, without a body, without an environment, it couldn't actually think in the rich, meaningful way humans do.
That's their point. It would lack the grounding, the interaction, the context. So the core idea they're pushing, the big reframing, is thinking as a verb.
An action. Something we do.
Something we actively do in and with the world. Not a noun, not a static thing inside the head. The whole book is structured that way. First, critique the old model, then build up the 4E framework piece by piece, and finally, show what it means for us today.
Okay, let's unpack those 4As then, starting with the body itself. Embodied and enacted thinking.
Right, so embodied. This starts with the idea that thinking is fundamentally dynamic. Chapter 2 talks about thinking in time. It's not like taking mental snapshots.
More like a stream.
Exactly, a continuous flow. Our thinking is always shaped by what we remember from the past. They call it retention, and what we're anticipating in the future pretension. We're constantly projecting ourselves, running little simulations.
And that shapes what we do right now.
Absolutely. Which leads directly into enacted thinking. The argument here is that all thinking, even the really abstract stuff, is grounded in action.
Okay. We often separate, like, knowing that facts and figures from knowing how, riding a bike, playing piano.
Right. But Gallagher and Dorman say even that abstract knowing that relies heavily on bodily action-based metaphors. Think about it. We talk about grasping an idea, building an argument, weighing the options.
Ah, right. It's all physical language we're using.
It is. So abstract thought isn't some completely separate faculty. It's more like a sophisticated extension of our basic embodied ways of interacting with the world.
That makes sense. I know when I'm really stuck on writing something, just getting up and pacing helps. It feels like the movement helps the thoughts move too.
That's a perfect example. Movement isn't a distraction from thinking. Often it is part of the thinking process itself.
Okay, so that's the body. Now let's move outwards into the environment and our tools. This is where it gets really wild, right? Embedded and extended thinking.
Yeah, this is where the traditional view really struggles. Chapter 4 covers embedded cognition. This means our thinking doesn't just happen in an environment. The environment itself plays an active role. It scaffolds our thinking.
Scaffolds? Like, it supports it.
Supports it, structures it, enables it. Huh. Think about using a large whiteboard to map out a complex project. That whiteboard isn't just like external memory. It's actively structuring your thought process, allowing you to handle complexity you couldn't manage just in your head.
So the layout of my desk or the tools available in a room, they literally shape how I think about a problem.
That's the idea. The physical structure of our surroundings, our cognitive niche, directly influences the kind of thinking we do. And this chapter also emphasizes the social aspect. We understand other people not by guessing their hidden thoughts,
but by seeing what they do, their gestures, their actions in the situation.
Exactly. Direct perception in a shared context. A lot of our thinking is actually distributed across groups. It's a social activity.
Okay. And then the really mind-bending one, extended mind. Tools aren't just helpers. They become part of the mind.
That's the claim. The classic example, as you mentioned earlier, is the blind person using a cane.
Right. They feel the world at the tip of the cane, not in their hand.
Precisely. The cane stops being just an external object and becomes integrated into their sensory system. It literally extends the boundary of their body and perception.
Okay, but let's take that to today. My smartphone, it holds my calendar, my notes, directs me everywhere. If that's part of my mind, and, oh, I drop it and it breaks, have I just suffered actual cognitive damage, like a form of amnesia?
Yeah.
That feels weird.
It does feel weird, but that's the provocative point they're making. They'd argue, yes, if that tool is reliably available, constantly used, and you trust it implicitly for certain cognitive tasks, like remembering appointments.
Which I absolutely do.
Then functionally, it has become part of your cognitive system.
Right.
If removing it causes a cognitive deficit, like forgetting all your meetings, then it was performing a cognitive function for you, or rather with you. The boundary isn't the skull anymore.
It's the skin plus.
Yeah.
Whatever is reliably integrated into that thinking loop. Wow.
Yeah. So let's maybe try and boil this down to a few core themes running through the book. First, and maybe most fundamentally, the complete dissolution of the mind-body split.
Right. No more goose to the machine. We're not minds stuck inside bodies. We are thinking bodies. Our physical feelings, our gut instincts. That's all part of cognition.
Exactly. Second theme, cognition as situated activity. Thinking isn't this universal, abstract thing happening in a vacuum. It's always shaped by the specific situation, the environment we're embedded in, the cultural tools and practices we use.
Makes sense. How you think in a library is different from how you think in a noisy workshop.
Totally. And the third big one, technology as cognitive extension. This is huge for today. Our tools, especially digital ones, aren't just things we use. They get woven into the very fabric of our thinking processes, extending our cognitive abilities.
We're becoming cyborgs, in a way.
In a functional sense, maybe. Our intelligence is becoming increasingly prosthetic.
The book seems packed with these really memorable lines or ideas. Let's highlight a few.
Okay. Well, summing up that first theme, you could paraphrase it as, we are not minds trapped in bodies. We are living, thinking bodies.
Simple, direct. Undoes centuries of dualism right there. Puts life back into thinking.
Yeah. Then for the extended mind, something like your notebook, your smartphone. When you use them consistently to work through a problem, they become part of your mind.
That really clarifies the how.
Yeah.
It's about reliable, functional integration into the task. Not just any old tool you pick up once.
Right. And maybe one more, capturing the enacted part and its practical side. To think better, often you need to act differently.
Ah, I like that. It puts the power back in our hands, literally. Thinking isn't just passive contemplation. Changing your actions, your environment, that's how you change your thoughts.
So what does this mean for you, listening day to day?
Well, the implications are pretty concrete. If thinking is embodied, then things like mindfulness or even just consciously changing your posture if you feel stuck or anxious, those aren't just wellness tips.
They're cognitive strategies.
They are cognitive strategies. You're not just thinking your way out of anxiety. You might need to breathe your way out or move your way out because the body state is part of the cognitive state.
And at work or trying to solve a problem. It means consciously designing your cognitive ecosystem. Stuck at your desk, don't just stare harder at the screen. Get up. Walk around that's thinking by walking. Grab a colleague. Find a whiteboard, leverage that embedded and social dimension. Use the physical space to help you think.
That makes so much sense for creative work. And what about learning for students?
Well, this 4E model is huge validation for active learning approaches. If thinking is enacted, then learning shouldn't be passive listening or reading alone. It should be hands-on.
Project-based learning, building things, doing experiments.
Exactly. Students embody knowledge when they learn by doing, by physically engaging with the material. It's not just about memorizing facts, it's about developing embodied understanding.
You know, what really struck me reading about this was the idea that even super abstract thinking like theoretical physics or deep philosophy is still ultimately grounded in our bodily experience and the metaphors we derive from it.
Right. It suggests the body's role never really disappears, no matter how mental the task seems.
So the big takeaway for me is, wow, my mind is literally bigger than my brain. My intelligence isn't fixed. It's dynamic. It's expandable. It includes bits of the world around me.
That's a great way to put it. And from an analytical perspective, this framework really challenges that dominant computer metaphor for the mind intelligence as just information processing.
Because it's missing the body, the world.
It's missing the embodiment, the embeddedness, the inaction, the interaction. Gallagher and Dorman would argue that true human-like intelligence needs all of that, not just faster chips. It changes how we should even evaluate AI.
Okay, so a final thought to leave our listeners with.
Well, building on that, if your mind genuinely extends into your tools, your phone, your environment, your social interactions, where do you actually end? What are the boundaries of yourself?
Whoa.
And maybe more practically, what responsibility does that give us? If our environments and our tools literally shape how we think and maybe even who we are, how carefully should we be choosing and designing them?
A lot to think about there, or perhaps a lot to enact out there. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.